18 minutes past midday. You're with Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday between 12 and 2. I'm joined in the studio by a Christian and a non-Christian guest as we debate some issue of belief or faith or differences in perspective. And we're looking today at the debate that exists between those who believe in a literal account, really, of the creation of the world as told in Genesis. And those, and this would of course include the majority of the scientific community, who believe in the evolutionary process that brought about things into the way we know them. It's of course generated a lot of heat. I don't know how much light it's created, but a lot of heat over in the USA, where there's been a long-running battle between certain school boards who have been looking to implement or to have some type of creationism or intelligent design, at least, taught alongside the evolutionary theories. Well, you only need to type in evolution or creationism into a Google web browser and you'll come up with all kinds of references to those sorts of debates. But we're taking your calls, emails and texts this afternoon as we discuss this. 08450 21 21 21 is the number. That's a local rate call wherever you are in the country. If you'd like to email us during the programme, studio@premier.org.uk, and the text line 64477. Premier should be the first word of your message. Now, of course, creationism is, if you like, one part in a spectrum, I suppose, of belief among Christians as to the how the world was created. And we're not suggesting on the programme that the views put forward are those of every Christian by any means, but they certainly are the views of a good deal of Christians, and we're going to be hearing exactly what those views are. So let's first of all say a very good afternoon let's start with Evan first of all. Good afternoon to you, Evan.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. Now, Evan, you are the Liberal Democrat spokesperson on science, and indeed you're part of the Common Science and Technology Select Committee. So I'm sure you've run into this debate in a number of different ways, haven't you?
From time to time. I mean, although you've introduced me as the non-Christian, I suspect the view that I hold, that understanding of the way the world began is best described by the evolution theory, is one held by a majority of Christians. It's only a minority of Christians, even of Christians, that hold to a creationist view of how the world began. That's not to say that people can't believe the Bible's overall message without believing literally everything it says, whether that be about creationism or the role of women or you know, how you treat gay people and all that. So I think that's important to be said.
Absolutely. There is, of course, a spectrum of belief in all these things. And
yeah, you also said a majority of scientists took the evolutionary view. I mean, I think you'd have to say the overwhelming majority of scientists, rather than a simple majority. There's very little in the way of debate now about the fundamental truth of evolution. Clearly there are gaps in the knowledge, and they have to
be. This is exactly what we are debating today, I suppose, in as much as the creationist wing, if you like, do believe that there are problems. Now, as to whether those are insurmountable or what, we'll sort of be looking into during the programme. But thank you for being with us, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this. Let's introduce our other guests for this afternoon's discussion. He is Paul Garner. He's a full-time researcher and lecturer with Biblical Creation Ministries. That's a charitable trust jointly established by the Biblical Creation Society and his home church, Soham Baptist Church. And thank you for coming in, first of all, Paul.
My pleasure.
Good to have you with us. Where did your interest first stem from in terms of this whole area of looking at the Bible as a paradigm for how the world was created?
I've always been interested in science. As a young boy, I knew that was what I wanted to be, and I used to collect fossils, and I was interested in dinosaurs, like lots of young boys are. And indeed, I went on to study science. My degree was in geology and biology. And I became a Christian when I was about 10 years old. And I began to read around this subject of creation and evolution and became a convinced creationist. And I was a creationist during the time I did my geology and biology studies.
Did not those studies throw up all kinds of questions as to the age of the earth and things like that when it came to, you know, a belief in some kind of creation argument?
Yes, it did. I mean, there are obviously lots of issues that we confront when we try to see how the science is reconciled with what the scripture says. But my basic position is that the facts themselves need to be interpreted. If you have a look at the way that science works, facts don't just speak for themselves. They have to be interpreted, and we interpret them according to a particular philosophical framework or worldview. And so really this whole issue is not about the facts, it's about how they're interpreted, and that very much depends on the presuppositions of the person who's doing the interpreting. And so creationists look at the same facts, the same rocks, fossils, living organisms, stars, galaxies, as an evolutionist, but because they come to the evidence with a different set of presuppositions, they interpret the evidence in a different way. And so as a scientist, that's what I'm interested in doing, seeing how the evidence can be interpreted in a way that's consistent with what the Bible reveals about the history of the world.
That's not science, you see. That's taking an article of faith that the Bible is true and allowing that to colour the interpretation of either facts or experimental findings. And that's not how science works. Science works on the basis, generally, of doing experiments, seeing what the best theory is that fits the experimental findings, and not actually interpreting it according to a worldview. Mm. That would be poor science. I'm sure there are people on the other side who like to do that, but that is not the scientific method, and where it does exist, it is rightly challenged. And so to say that a view that you fundamentally believe in the truth of the Bible and you can interpret all scientific facts as the creative human mind can to fit in with that view as a scientific approach is not right, and very few scientists or indeed philosophers would agree with that.
Okay.
Can I just come back on that and just say that I think, respectfully, that's a very naive view of the way that science actually operates. All scientists come to the evidence with a set of presuppositions. They all have a worldview.
It's called bias, yes.
And they come with a set of biases. And the main philosophical view that dominates thinking about the history of the universe today is the philosophy of naturalism, the idea that nature is all that there is, or at least when we conduct scientific inquiry about origins, we have to operate as though that were true.
Mm.
Now, someone has said that if that's the philosophy that we come to the evidence with, then something like evolution has to be true by default. But what we're saying is that actually naturalism...
No, it doesn't have to be true by default. No one's arguing that.
Well, if you come to the evidence with the view that nature is all that there is, which is the materialist view that dominates scientific thinking today, then it has to be true by default. And you can't consider, for example, whether intelligent agency played a role in the history of the universe.
You can consider and you can look for evidence. I just want to interrupt to say that when I argued that if you come to something with presuppositions, it's bias, you agreed. What most scientists, I would say all scientists, would argue is that bias is a bad thing, it's inevitable, and therefore you design experiments and you ensure that there's good peer review, that's have other people look at it, in order to get round bias. What you seem to do is say your bias is for a particular view, and you're entitled to that view, and you're going to rejoice in it. You're going to say, great to have this bias, and everything will fit with the bias. I'm not arguing that bias doesn't exist subjectively for every scientist, but most scientists, true to the scientific method, try and identify it and avoid it influencing the assumptions that they make, the findings that they get, because otherwise that would be fraud, and the conclusions they draw from those findings.
Well, I'll tell you what, gentlemen, we're getting into the debate now, and obviously this is going to be a lively one, and I'm enjoying it already, but we're going to take a quick break now and give people a chance to have a think about what's been said already and put their calls to us. If you're interested in having a question or a comment put to either of our guests today, Evan Harris, who is Liberal Democrat spokesperson on science defending evolution, and Paul Garner of Biblical Creation Ministries, who is, as you would expect, defending the biblical creationist side of things, then do call in. 08450 21 21 21 is the number, and we'd be delighted to take your calls. This is open to everyone. This is not just a Christian talk show by any means, so if you're listening and you agree with Evan, or you find yourself somewhere in the middle or wherever, then do call in. 08450 21 21 21, and we'll also welcome your emails at studio@premier.org. org.uk. And again, the text line, 25p, it'll cost you, plus your standard network charge. That's 64477, and Premier should be the first word of your message. We look forward to taking your calls, emails and texts. Well, we're going to have a discussion this afternoon on creationism and evolution. Why one of our guests believes that evolution doesn't stand up to rigorous analysis, and why our other guest believes that creationists have an agenda that they're pushing, and it simply doesn't add up as science, as we've already been hearing from him. The time right now is 29 minutes past midday. You're listening to Unbelievable. 31 minutes past midday.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we've got an interesting debate for you this afternoon between now and 2 o'clock. We're asking, what is the account of creation? Christians say, obviously, God created the world. Of course, there's a wide spectrum of opinion as to whether that means God set in process the evolutionary sort of scheme that most scientists would sign up to, the vast majority of scientists would sign up to. But there is a significant and growing number of Christians who say, actually, it does make sense to look at the Genesis account and choose that as a literal paradigm of how the world was created. One of those is with us in the studio, Paul Garner. He's from Biblical Creation Ministries, and he says we can trust the Bible's account of Earth history, and that the book of Genesis is foundational to the Christian gospel and vital if we're going to have a correct understanding of physical and biological origins. What do you think? 08450 21 21 21. On the other side of our debate is Evan Harris, Liberal Democrat MP, and their spokesperson on science. He, of course, coming on to defend the standard, if you like, evolutionary model of how to see the world. Once again, the number 08450 21 21 21. We'll be taking some of your calls shortly. And, of course, your emails, they're already starting to come in. studio@premier.org.uk. Well, let's go back and start again looking at this debate, because there's all sorts of different parts of this that we need to unpack. And perhaps, first of all, we've started talking, gentlemen, already about the fact that, obviously, Evan, you don't see this as scientific. And this is one of the major criticisms leveled at both a very literal creationist account and indeed the intelligent design theories that are out there, that you start from something which, as you say, Evan, appears to be a major bias. Now, let's go back to you again, Paul, and get from you, why don't you believe that the fact that you're coming at things with the basis that you believe the Bible and its account, why for you does that not pose a problem? Because aren't you, in a sense, don't you already have the conclusion before you've found the evidence to point towards it?
Absolutely every scientist, without exception, comes to the evidence with a certain bias and presuppositions. An atheist, before he goes to look at the evidence, is 100% convinced of his atheism, and therefore he will interpret the evidence in a way that is consistent with that. Evan was saying that this isn't how science works, but actually it is how science works. Let me just tell you what Dr. Scott Todd said. He's an immunologist from Kansas State University. And a few years ago, in the leading science journal Nature, he wrote a letter in which he said, even if all the evidence points to intelligent design as the explanation for the origin of the universe, that explanation cannot be considered because it's not naturalistic. In other words, someone who comes to the evidence with a naturalistic bias is every bit as biased in the way that they approach the evidence as someone who believes the Bible. All scientists are in that position. Science is a human endeavor, and it's something we can't escape from. What I'm saying is we need to be open and honest about the biases that we bring. I'm open and honest about the fact that I believe the Bible is an accurate, historical, and reliable account of the history of the universe, and I use it as a framework in which to interpret the scientific data. And I think the scientific data, the scientific evidence, confirms what the Bible says.
Okay, Evan, do you
it's
accept
ridiculous.
That?
No, I don't accept it for. I don't accept a shred of it for 1 minute. You can't argue that what every scientist does is on the basis of a random quote from one person in one journal. I speak for myself. And the point is that most scientists would say they don't know the answer. That's what scientists say. They don't know the answer, so they do an experiment and they learn from that. What people who come from a creationist position or any article of faith, and it needn't be creationist, there are plenty of articles of faith out there that are not religious, is that this is what we know to be the truth, and we're going to seek to confirm that. Politicians do that a lot when they try and get research to back up their little theories we saw from dodgy dossiers. And that way lies despair and inaccurate research, fundamentally flawed, and I would say it's corrupt. I would say it's scientific fraud to say that you know the answer to start with, and therefore you're going to, even if you found bits and pieces that confirm that, that is selectively
but
scouring the scientific evidence.
Isn't Paul's
evidence.
Point that that most scientists coming at this from a naturalistic point of view, they already have, you know, their answer as well, in that it can't be of any other origin than naturalistic?
No, I can give you two rebuttals to that. Firstly, there's a large number of religious people who accept the science behind the science that underlies evolution, the fact, for example, that radioactivity decays at a standard rate and things have been decaying for longer than since before 4004 BC, which is what Paul would argue was the beginning of the universe. They would argue that the speed of light has always been constant, and therefore light that has risen from stars millions, indeed billions of years ago, has always arisen from stars at that point. That doesn't mean they're not religious. They just recognize the science. And there are no atheists, as far as I'm aware, or vanishingly few, who agree with with creationism. So it isn't, it's plague on all your houses. And we could just argue about any phenomenon. Gravity isn't gravity. It's God or the spirit world or some ghost pulling things to earth, because I believe it is. And I'm just going to interpret everything I see about apples falling from trees on the basis of a hidden spirit world that's pulling apples down from trees. It's not a basis to do science or to have a rational argument.
Of course, we want to move beyond this to some of those specific examples you mentioned, which you know, on the face of it, do seem insurmountable obstacles to any literalist interpretation of the Bible story. But before we do, let's have a call from Randall Hardy in Manchester, who I believe is from a creation researcher, a sort of similar organisation to Paul's. Randall, you wanted to talk about this question of whether science is unbiased.
Yes, I do, Justin. Good afternoon, Paul, and afternoon to Evan, who I've never met, but I'd like to put my question to.
Sure.
Evan, you're saying that science and philosophy have always been apart. So could you give me your comment, please, on what Charles Lyell wrote in a letter back in 1830? Now, I don't know if you've probably heard of Charles Lyell, but for those who haven't, Lyell's considered to be the father of modern geology, and there's a very well-known quote from Charles Darwin, considered to be the father of evolution, who said, "I always feel as if my books came half out of Lyell's brain, and that I never acknowledge that sufficiently." Now, Lyell wrote to this friend of his, George Scrope, as I say, in 1830, and he says, "I'm sure you may get into the Quarterly Review, what will free science from Moses? For if treated seriously, the church party are ready for it." He then, interestingly, has a paragraph where he advises his friend not to meddle with the Quran, which is very topical today. But then he goes on to finish this section of the letter by saying, "I conceived the idea 5 or 6 years ago that if ever Mosaic geology could be set down without giving offence, it would be in a historical sketch." So we see from his own words that Charles Lyell had a religious agenda, even when he was laying the foundations for Charles Darwin's thinking for his theory of evolution. Have you come across that quote before, Evan, and what's your comment on it?
Well, I'm not sure I see the relevance to the point you're making. I mean, I haven't come across that quote. I'm not, unlike you or Paul, full-time on evolution. I have a job that touches on this in terms of science spokesmanship. Yeah, indeed. The point I'm making is, and I've never made the point, that philosophy is different from science, and so I don't understand that presumption. And I've also made the point that I recognize that bias exists in scientists. The point is that serious scientists legitimate scientists recognize that bias, and they take huge amounts of effort, as do the people that peer review their funding applications and peer review their request to publish their data, do everything possible to ensure that those biases are dealt with and accounted for, and therefore that the experimental design, the assumptions of the conclusions drawn are not due to bias. You see it in medicine all the time.
Yeah,
there's a control group.
But we're talking about geology and we're talking about biology. Now, was Charles Lyell's work peer-reviewed in that way?
I'm not sure what point... perhaps the presenter can help here. What point I'm supposed to be answering in respect of Mr. Lyell. I've already argued that there are plenty of religious people who recognise evolution and see that that's good science. I don't have a problem with that.
Well, what I'm trying to put to you is that the whole foundation of evolutionary theory is based on a religious bias of, first and foremost, Charles Lyell, and then Charles Darwin. You see, Charles Lyell's work was never reviewed until in February 1975. You've probably heard of the late Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard University. He wrote about Charles Lyell that he was a lawyer by profession, and his book is one of the most brilliant briefs
published. I see the point you're making. I think what you're saying is that because one of the early evolutionary researchers had a religious agenda, that therefore evolution is founded on the basis of a biased approach. That the point about science, and evolution is a good example of this, is that it's based on the work of thousands of scientists, one building on the other, each questioning the assumptions, experimental design, and conclusions, and each adding to the body of knowledge. And the overwhelming body of knowledge supports an evolutionary approach to the origins of life on this planet.
Let's allow Paul to come in again on here, because I think you've been listening, Paul, and you'd like to put some points on
this. Charles Lyell is a very interesting character in the history of science, because he has cast a shadow over the whole of science ever since the 1830s when he wrote his Principles of Geology. Charles Lyell is credited with introducing, or at least developing, and building on the work of James Hutton to develop this principle of uniformitarianism. And that Lyellian uniformitarianism, which says that the present is the key to the past, that all processes go on in the past at the same rate as they always have done and as they do today, that rigid principle of uniformity has had a stifling effect in both geology and biology ever since. And in fact, to go back to some of the specific examples that Evan brought up of evidence that supposedly disproves the biblical account of creation, he was basing those ideas on a strict and rigid application of the principle of uniformity, which I think can be seriously questioned today.
I mean, I'm slightly still confused, along possibly with Evan here, about why this particular agenda that this person had. Obviously, he was foundational in the evolutionary approach, but what difference does it make now, 160 years on?
Because Charles Lyell's views are still hugely influential. There has, in recent years, particularly in the science of geology, there's been something of a move away from the rigid application of this principle of uniformity, which says all processes occur at the same rate in the past as they do today. And there is beginning to be a recognition of catastrophism in the geological record.
The point you're making,
blocks were laid down in 4004 BC, and that there's some evidence somewhere that radioactive decay that suggests that something decays over tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years.
All right, let's lay out this one.
I don't understand. Explain.
I'll be glad to explain. The latest research that's been done clearly shows that there's strong evidence that radioactive decay rates have varied in the Earth's past. For example, in New Mexico, back in the 1980s, they did some crustal drilling for a geothermal energy project. And one of the curious results from that crustal energy project was that they found large amounts of helium trapped in the crust of the Earth. Now, helium is a byproduct of radioactive decay, and there was lots of helium trapped in those crustal rocks. The thing that surprised them was that there was so much of it there, because helium is a slippery gas. It diffuses very readily through the rocks and minerals of the Earth's crust. And the helium ought to be today in the atmosphere. But nobody had done any experiments to measure helium diffusion through these rocks. It was just intuitive. So a group of creationists in America, geologists and geophysicists, got together.
A group of people who had their who knew the answer before.
Okay, we'll leave this.
Okay. The point I'd like to make is, on this point about radioactive decay, the whole of nuclear physics is wrong.
Evan,
what are we doing now? It's evolution. It's nuclear physics is wrong.
So perhaps I could just finish the point. This team of geologists sent samples. Sent samples to an evolutionary scientist, and they contracted the work to him, and what they asked him to do was simply give them the first ever measurements of helium diffusion through these zircon and biotite minerals. And the results came back, and the helium diffusion age for these rocks is close to 6,000 years, plus or minus 2,000 years was the margin of error. In other words, there is absolutely no way that helium could still be there in the rocks if those rocks are 1.5 billion years of the conventional view.
For those who are listening who maybe don't...
We will get
your comment in just a moment, Evan. I just want, for the benefit of those who are listening and maybe not sure what this is that we're referring to, let's just get to the point here, which is that creationists believe that the Earth is a certain number of years old based on a kind of looking at the Old Testament and what it appears to say about how many years people lived and etc. And from that point of view, you would say the Earth yourself, Paul, is how many years old now?
I think it's less than 10,000 years old.
Now, radioactive carbon dating appears to suggest that rocks, etc., are much older than that, but you're saying this evidence that was uncovered of the helium diffusion appears to contradict that evidence.
It shows that there has been lots of radioactive decay because helium is a byproduct of decay, and there was lots of helium in the rocks. But the helium diffusion measurement showed that the helium ought to have seeped out of those rocks
Method, if you like, it showed the rocks are less than 10,000 years old.
Yes.
By the radioactive method, it would show they are older than that.
So what that shows is that radioactive decay rates must have been faster in the past to generate lots of helium, but that was only within the last few thousand years.
No, I don't think it shows that at all. I mean, clearly, if this work has been published in a paper, then someone's on to win a Nobel Prize, and I wait to see. Obviously, I haven't read the paper, but I'm fascinated to see which journal it's in, whether it's been peer reviewed, and I wait to see the Nobel Prize for this thing that overturns all of the science upon which we base how everything works. Actually, in our technological age, so I'm worried about getting in my car now. But the point I'd like to make is that I haven't seen that published, but there have been tons and tons, if you look at the paper, literally thousands of tons of journals pointing out that if you take strata from the Jurassic period, 150 million years ago, there are no human fossils found in there. The human fossils only exist in more recently laid down rocks, which are younger, not older, that come from a younger period. So there's one alleged paper which allegedly suggests something, which allegedly suggests something else, which I don't think has been agreed with by science, versus thousands and thousands of findings upon which scientists are confident to base their views that life has evolved on this Earth and that the Earth is more than 10,000 years old, of the order of, or the universe is nearly 5 billion years old.
Just a quick response and we're going to move on.
It's a minor disagreement. It's a fundamental thousands of orders of magnitude.
Well, that was just one of the studies that was conducted by this group over an 8-year period. One of the other things that group documented is that you can use multiple radiometric dating methods, radioactive dating methods, on the same rock samples, and you will get a wide scatter of dates. For example, a couple of years ago, I was in the Grand Canyon, and at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, there's a series of lava flows called the Cardenas Basalts. And they've been dated by a variety of methods. And the potassium-argon method says that they're 516 million years old. The samarium-neodymium method says that they're 1,700 million years old. And the rubidium-strontium method says they're 1,090 million years old. Now, the question is, which of those is true? My answer would be none of the above, because these methods are not giving the true age of the rocks.
We're going to move on.
They're all about a million out. Okay, so they're out by a factor of a million. So, I mean, what you're saying there is that whatever method of radioactive decay you analyze, they're millions of years old, and yet your view is that rock is the same as everything else in this planet, exactly just under 10,000 years old. In fact, 6,004.
Just a very quick response from Paul.
10 years old doesn't make sense.
Well, that's your belief.
You're entitled to have these beliefs, but don't impose them and attack every other scientist for being unscientific.
I'm not attacking scientists. I'm just trying to understand what these radiometric dates mean. I just don't think they give us the true age of the rocks. One of the interesting things as well, you said that can we really believe that all these dating methods are so far out? Well, the truth is that almost every modern-day lava flow that is dated by potassium-argon gives ages of hundreds of thousands to millions of years, even though we know the date at which these rocks were formed. They were formed within historical times.
Let's move on here, gentlemen. I know there's so much we can talk about, but lots of people have been phoning, texting and emailing. Let's just read some of these texts before we move on. I'll just read a brief snippet of some of them. This one from Francis says, I think that people who feel unconvinced about intelligent design should look at answersingenesis.com. Very informative, says Francis. Premier, even Scientology accepts that man is too unique to have come from apes, never mind the amoeba, besides the consensus among biochemists. And there's a number of other things coming through as well. We've also got an email here. This one comes from Kathy in Ashford. She says, what is the question that you'll be asking? I feel there are two different questions that are often taken as one. The first, why was the world made? This relates to creation. The Bible is not interested in how it happened. The second, how was the world made? That relates to evolution, and that's only interested in the scientific side. And I believe the two can, for the most part, exist side by side. I think this is probably where most Christians find themselves, Paul, as Evan has said. The majority of Christians do believe the scientific evolutionary account, and they would just say, well, look, God, I still believe God created the world, but he just sort of, he worked through this process of evolution. Now, you obviously don't believe that. Why do you feel it has to be as Genesis told the story, a literal interpretation?
The reason that I believe we have to understand Genesis as a historical account is because it's foundational to the entire Christian worldview. If you look at the central message of Christianity, which is what Jesus Christ accomplished on the cross in order to save people from sin, that message is founded in the events of Genesis chapters 1-3. If there wasn't a real man called Adam who actually lived historically, who rebelled against God, if there wasn't an actual fall into sin that brought a physical and spiritual separation from God, then the cross itself doesn't make sense.
Let's just bring in Carolyn Eastley, and then we'll get another response from Evan, because Carol is on this very subject, I believe, and she's about to come on the line now. A good afternoon to you, Carol.
Hiya.
Hi there. You're a Christian, Carol, are
yes.
you? And yes. you feel that creation and evolution can live together quite happily?
Very easily and comfortably. I don't see any problem with the two of them living together.
Paul, explain to Carol why you believe that you have to believe a literal account of Genesis to get your Christianity right.
Okay. Evolution inevitably requires millions and millions of years of death and bloodshed before man even appeared on the earth. The Bible clearly says that death, physical death and bloodshed, came into the world because of man's sin, and that this is why Jesus Christ came to die. He came so that he could live a perfect life, the kind of life that Adam ought to have lived, and yet go to the cross and shed his blood and physically die and be spiritually cut off from God, because that was the punishment for sin. Where do we learn that? Genesis chapter 3. If Genesis chapter 3 is not historical, and evolution says that the events of Genesis chapter 3 cannot be true, they cannot have occurred in the straightforward way that we read there, then I would say the central message of Christianity has been undermined.
Carol, you obviously are a believer in Jesus Christ and the message of the gospel. For you, why does believing in evolution not counter that in the way that Paul's suggesting it does?
Well, I think I make the point that Genesis 1 talks about 7 days. Seven is a perfect number in the Bible. 7 days is used for a lot of things. I take it as meaning it took the perfect time to create up to that point. And they do point out that actually animals were dying before then because they were being killed for Adam for food. Therefore, that did happen. And also, the fall into sin is a symbolic fall of something which happened through how things happened.
Presumably you would say that if you follow the evolutionary process whereby humans evolved from, you know, primates, etc., that it was at the moment that, I suppose, human consciousness became apparent, that then the, if you like, the sinful element could be established. Would it be something along those lines, Carol?
Along those lines, but see, it's the humans, even from their very earliest forms, I mean, even the apes have some understanding of life and death and how things work in a very primitive way. So all animals have a level of spiritual understanding. It doesn't have to be a mental understanding.
Mm, mm. Carol, thank you very much. Paul, we're running out of time before we get to the break, and we should talk to Evan as well. But you feel that you can't have that evolutionary process for the point about Adam and sin to be relevant in Christianity.
There are over 200 references to the book of Genesis in the New Testament. It's one of the most quoted from books of the Old Testament in the New Testament. Jesus himself referred on at least 25 occasions to the early chapters of Genesis. He referred to Adam and Eve. He referred to Cain and Abel. He referred to Noah. He referred to them as historical characters, and he based his ministry and he explained his life's work on the basis of those things. He said that if we don't believe the writings of Moses, then how will we believe what he said? Mm. And I think that's a very good question.
Okay. We're running out of time, so we're going to have to take some comments from Evan on this. Obviously, this touches on more.
I thought you'd forgotten about me.
I haven't forgotten about you, Evan, but time is beating us, I'm afraid, and we're going to have to take a break here. But time for us to marshal our thoughts and think about the things that have been raised. If you'd like to call in, don't forget, it's 08450 21 21 21, and we'll give Evan a chance to respond to some of these comments and some of the things that have been coming on in these last 10 minutes or so. You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable as we discuss creationism versus evolution. Perhaps you've got an opinion on it. Do you believe a literal biblical account? Tell us why. Perhaps you don't. You feel evolution is compatible with Christian faith. We'd like to hear from you too.
Radio.
Very busy programme today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we're talking about evolutionism versus creationism, or evolution, I suppose. I think there was a slight debate going on before this programme as to how to pronounce it. And I believe the English pronunciation is actually evolution. That's according to Paul, my guest here in the studio. Evolution being the American way of doing things. So forgive me, whichever one I use, whether you're listening in the UK or America today. Let's take a look at some of the comments that have been coming in before we go again to hear from Evan, who is defending the evolution record of how the world came into being. Anthea in Waltham Abbey says science is a culture which is not open-minded because research has to be funded. If evolutionists are funding science, they won't fund a science which is contradicted. And Annie in Leatherhead says, how do evolutionists explain away men's missing rib? That's an interesting one. Maybe Evan, you wanted to come back anyway to some of the things that we've been talking about. I think that's true, isn't it? Men do have one less rib. Is that not true? No. Do men have any difference in ribs between men and women?
I think that's
minimum
a fallacy.
Go ahead, Evan.
It's my turn.
Yes, so go ahead.
Well, thank goodness for that. I know a little bit about anatomy.
Yes.
And it really does concern me that let's not get into it. No, is the answer. Same number of ribs.
Yeah.
Of course, God probably regrew the rib that was taken from Adam. I mean, this is the sort of thing we're dealing with, that there is an interesting story element to the Bible, and I learnt it as much as everything else. And I went through some of my life believing some of the things that the Bible said, literally. And it's simply not borne out by the facts. Now, that can always be explained away because God allowed another rib to grow. But the point that I'd like to come back to is this idea that there's this massive conspiracy of all people in the world who fund science, or the vast majority of them, who are all deeply cynical, evil people who want to do down the truth and want to invest their money, whether it's comes from genetic work, which is obviously key to evolution, is key to that, to fund new treatments. that these research charities and doctors all throughout the world are all conspiring against evolution by being involved in this, you know, say, profound conspiracy not to fund any research that undermines evolution. It's rubbish, of course. It's the sort of conspiracy, the sort of theory that is the allegation of the desperate. And I think creationists who are, take a literal view of these things are desperate to argue that anyone who disagrees with them is biased and doesn't recognize their bias, and that they aren't biased, or if they are biased, it's a good thing and they will rejoice and wallow in it. And it is really not science. And that's why I object to creationism being taught in science classes. It is an article of faith, as we've heard, and indeed it's a very important article of faith to fundamentalists who believe that unless you believe in the whole literal truth of the Bible, you can't believe in Jesus, as Paul's just explained from his perspective. And I think fundamentalism is very dangerous when, in order to get across the view that it's an all or nothing, okay, and that you have to believe in absolutely everything, and we hear it in other religions as well, that we have to corrupt science lessons in schools to bring in this conspiracy theory and this anti-scientific, it's not just unscientific, it's anti-scientific approach.
Presumably, Paul, you do believe that even those who disagree with you on creationism, who are Christians, are still Christians. It's just you believe there's an incompatibility in their thinking. It's not that you would say, are they not Christians, because
no,
they don't believe the creationist account.
Of course not. I know many Christians who are good Christian people who accept evolution, but I would respectfully challenge them and say, what is the biblical basis for trying to incorporate evolutionary ideas into what the Bible says? I think they're incompatible, and I think it does undermine the New Testament message.
Okay, let's move on, because we've got a number of people who are interested in putting their comments by phone. Let's talk to Noel in Norbury. Hi there, Noel.
Oh, hello.
Hello. What did you want to say?
Well, I'd like to say that I disagree with Evan, who claims that the creationist view is the only one which is compatible with the scriptures. That's nothing like so at all. In fact, I hold to either a theistic evolutionary view or progressive creationist view. There are two
forgive me now. You're disagreeing with Paul.
Who's
saying that you have to hold a creationist view
to be a consistent
Christian. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to say that there are two other views, theistic evolution or progressive creation. Now, in theistic evolution, God is the ultimate cause of the whole evolutionary process. He starts it and off, and everything else proceeds onwards. In progressive creation, at various stages in the evolutionary process, God actually has a role in that. Now, just to continue that, I'd like to say that the theology that Paul suggests on the basis of creation, we don't need to actually follow that. If you can actually believe evolution and be a Christian at the same time, as long as you hold to the theology of Acts chapter 17. And I'd like to all the people who are listening to this to note that when Paul spoke to the Athenians in Athens in Acts chapter 17, he did not have to invoke anything related to Genesis 3:15 in a literal interpretation. Those people who take Genesis 3:15 literally need not to do so, because that is that is incompatible with what I would say is a reasonable interpretation of things. In Acts chapter 17, if you were to read that, you would note that Paul talks about God making all men of one blood, one flesh, etc., and God allows man to continue in ignorance, making gods and idols and so on, because man, basically, I'm just paraphrasing, has a moral instinct. So, if God, according to the theistic evolution, allows man evolve a sufficient moral instinct to be accountable for sin, there's your accountability for sin.
Well, we understand where you're coming from there, and we'll allow Paul a quick chance to reply to that. But thank you very much for your call. I mean, and I'd like to then move on from this, because obviously, there's lots of other things to discuss. But Paul.
Well, just very quickly, obviously Acts 17 is all about Genesis, because it talks about how God, from one man, made every nation of men that dwell on the earth. I mean, it clearly is a reference there to Adam and the historicity of the early chapters of Genesis. And of course, you only have to go in other places in Paul's writings, in 1 Corinthians 15, where he talks about, for as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive, and the book of Romans the same. You can find that Paul absolutely believed in the historical nature of Genesis.
Well, Evan, from your point of view, all this is somewhat by the by, because at the end of the day, this whole debate as to whether to be a Christian you have to believe the Genesis account literally, it makes no bones on the scientific
evidence. Well, it matters to me as a politician, because there are fundamentalists in all religions who want to really control the thoughts of other people, and they say, you have to take everything I say. You can't just pick a little bit, like belief that Jesus existed and people are somehow redeemed through his death. You have to take the whole thing, and that means that everyone else who disagrees with any of this is wrong, and you're on our side. And that's one of the problems with religious fundamentalism, and that's why we need to protect children in school. I mean, obviously parents and churches can do as they wish, but children in school from being told that they must believe something instead of they must doubt something and they must inquire. And scientific method is the most reliable way of inquiring about areas of doubt, in my view.
Let's look at scientific method, because you already brought up one or two examples which you believe contradict any possibility of a creationist account of an earth that is less than 10,000 years old. Go back to the one you gave about the fact that light travels at a certain speed. What was the point you were making on that one?
Well, I think it's generally accepted, unless more fundamental laws of physics are about to be rebutted on the basis of unpublished articles or uncited articles by one person, usually in America, that light travels at a certain speed, and we know the distance involved from one star, from a star to the Earth, and we know that the light coming from those stars, therefore, must have started out its journey millions of years ago. Let's just leave it at that. So you would have to, if you believe that the universe, not just the Earth, but the universe was created something like 6,010 years ago, plus or minus a few months, then you have to believe that the universe was created with light already on its way some way. That's the sort of contortion you have to go through. So regardless of whether there's a God or not, a literal interpretation of Genesis, and indeed everything else in the Bible,
essentially you're saying you have to jump through a lot of hoops to make it all fit together. And for you, the simplest explanation is
jumping
simply
jumping through hoops will be too easy an analogy, I think.
Okay, well, Paul.
The logical explanation is that, the stars were created and they emitted light, and it took millions of years for that light to reach us. It's not easy. I mean, science isn't easy. There's been, hundreds of years and, millions of person hours gone into this.
Let's allow Paul to respond, though, and then we'll get your response, Evan. This seems like a problem, Paul. What's your account of it?
Well, Evan is clearly not aware about the tremendous amount of work that's been done to develop alternative views of the universe other than the Big Bang theory, based on Einstein's theory of general relativity. According to relativity theory, yes, the speed of light is a constant, but we know that time, in Einstein's theory, is distorted by gravity. And you can develop alternative cosmologies to the Big Bang, where because of gravitational time dilation, light has time to reach the Earth within only a short period of time as measured by clocks on the Earth. Now, that's a hugely complex area, and I'm not sure we want to get into all of the details about that, but the papers are out there for anyone who wants to look at them. But if we're talking about jumping through hoops here, I mean, let's just look at some of the problems that evolutionists face.
Before you move off this light,
all right,
by saying there's papers out there. You see, what you say is the Bible's there, read it, okay? And then you quote some papers that you know that people won't be able to understand, even if they could find them, and say, look, here you are, you've got an easy written account, and everything else is complicated science, okay? The idea that anyone accepts that there were clocks on Earth thousands of years ago is a little peculiar. And
no, that's not what I said.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure the point you're making. Arguably, if indeed gravitational fluxes could change our measurement of time in a way that affected this issue.
Well, it does.
Then maybe Genesis, the days referred to in Genesis, were not real days, but maybe gravity was acting differently in those days, and maybe you've just solved your own problem. That a day, as in Genesis terms, was not actually a day. Would you consider using your own solution to solve that problem? Was the only truth that gravity doesn't play a part is the day is a day is a day, a la Genesis?
These alternative cosmologies are based on sound and well-attested physics. Numerous experiments have shown that gravity has a distorting effect on time. You can put an atomic clock on an aeroplane and you find that it ticks at a slightly different rate than an atomic clock on the surface of the Earth, because they're in different locations within the Earth's gravitational field. And if we don't make the assumptions that go into the Big Bang theory, but we use Einstein's theory to develop alternative cosmologies, then we find that there are resolutions to this issue of scale, light, and time.
If you're trying to argue that Einstein's a creationist, then I think you're not going to win that one.
Evan also asked the question, could you use that very argument and apply it to the biblical 7 days and say, well, you know, maybe a day wasn't a day back then, it was something quite different?
Well, interestingly enough, there is actually, I think he's a Jewish physicist who has argued something similar to that, kind of the converse of what I was arguing about the effects of gravitational time dilation. But yeah, there are potential solutions within relativistic physics.
Why is that not right?
Why is it not right?
I mean, the fact that no one else agrees with it, or the same number of people agree with that as agree with your theory about the speed of light, shouldn't matter to you, because you're happy being in a tiny minority. But why do you believe that that is wrong? Why don't you amend your views to fit in with that? You could still then believe in Genesis.
I think that what we need to do in all of these issues to do with historical science, where we're looking at basically processes going on in the past that are actually beyond direct observation, they're not repeatable, they're historical events, I think we need to look at a multiple number of hypotheses and not automatically try to close debate down and say that there's only one answer, which is evolution. When you were speaking earlier about imposing views, no one on the creationist side is wanting to impose views. What we're wanting is a level playing field. We're just wanting to be heard. The ones who are actually closing down debate and making sure that only one view is heard are those who say that creationist views should not be considered in the realm of education.
In the realm of science. In religious education, fine. You can teach children in religion that what they need to do is just have faith, believe these literal accounts, and some children may take that on board. But that should be set out as religion.
Okay.
But science is not about believing things are so. It's about teaching how to inquire. That's what
Absolutely.
Humans are capable of doing. And what worries me about religious fundamentalism is that it's the opposite of that. It says you must believe this, and you can't just believe this. You've got to believe everything I'm saying. Follow me, sometimes giving 10% of your income to me to subscribe to this view, sometimes not. And that is what I think is a bad thing. We see in the world, if you don't mind me expanding this a little further, the dangers of religious fundamentalism, because there's no possibility of negotiation. And science is entirely different. Science says we will doubt everything we do, we'll check it, we'll try and repeat experiments, we'll get other people in competition
okay.
with us to agree whether our approach is correct.
Okay, thank you I understand where you're coming from there. We're going to take a very quick break here, just for 20 seconds or so. I'll come back with some emails, lots of you wanting to get your comments across in that way, and then we'll hear from John in Leeds, and we'll be continuing this very exciting debate. 19 minutes past one. You're listening to an edition of Unbelievable, where we're looking at creationism and evolution. Lots of you have been emailing. Let me just read some of your comments. Kelly says, I noted that at the start, Evan said most Christians believe in evolution. I'd like some statistics to confirm that view. I don't have any of those to hand, Kelly, but I think I'd agree with him on that, those who sort of put their cards on the table. You say, I also want to comment on comments made by the caller, Carol. I think we shouldn't put such strong interpretations on the Bible. I think that God was perfectly clear in Genesis as to how many days he created the earth. If it took him 7 million or 15 billion or whatever, then God would have said that. Okay, thank you. Ayor in Tooting says, they are saying that stars are light years away. How was this measured when nothing has reached any star? This is just based on assumptions like most of the scientific theories. Okay, thank you, Ayor. And this one from Bob Greenfield, he puts about six problems that he has with evolution, including, and maybe we could just have a quick discussion on this, the idea that a complex world could be formed by chance. He said it would take a monkey 77 billion years to play the first 12 notes of Handel's Messiah, hitting one key per second at random on a 50-key keyboard. How on earth can a world of our complexity have been formed by chance? I suppose, Evan and Paul, this is something that often, you know, sparks the whole debate in the first place, that that the complex world we live in could be, you know, a random process.
It's not a random process. I mean, clearly chance plays a part in evolution because of random mutations that give rise to new traits, new characteristics that equip someone to survive better or worse in the environment. But in fact, it's the opposite of chance. Natural selection, which is the principal known mechanism of evolution, harnesses non-random change by preserving desirable features, that's adaptive features, and eliminating undesirable. So if you look at it, actually, it's actually not chance, it's predictable. So as long as the forces of selection stay constant, then natural selection can push evolution in one direction, and you can create quite a lot of complexity in too short a time. I mean, I don't know where to start. I can go into the sort of, you know, to be or not to be, random 13-letter sequence and monkeys at typewriters to show what I'm saying here. But the argument that this is a process solely relying on chance is wrong, but it's polemic. It's what people who take a different view do, and that's fine. But it isn't a scientific rebuttal.
I think Evan has a real problem here, because one of the reasons that I'm a creationist and many others are creationists is because we've looked at this mechanism of evolution by natural selection and random mutations, and we find that actually it's very inadequate to explain the diversity of life. Natural selection adds absolutely nothing new. It can only select from what already exists, and mutations are basically losses of genetic information. They're degenerative. Even the ones that are, in a narrow survival sense, beneficial, you find that actually they've lost information from the genome. And if we're saying that we're not relying on chance here, maybe that's the case with natural selection. You can argue that the selective process is not entirely random. But what about the origin of life? Before you have a living organism, you can't have natural selection before you have a self-reproducing organism. So how did the first self-reproducing organism come about? You have to rely on chance to do that. And that is, I would say, a real stretch. It's a preposterous idea now, that chemicals just self-assembled.
I will give you a chance to respond, Evan, but John in Leeds, I believe, is on this very subject. So maybe you could add in your thoughts here, John. Good afternoon to you.
Hello. Hello there. Hi.
Yeah, what was the point
Paul
to make?
Paul's just beaten me to the post. I was going to bring up the point that anybody, even a non-scientist, can see that a cell is an incredibly complex thing, absolutely incredibly complex. And the idea that all the chemicals could come together, even that the large molecules could form by themselves, and that they could then come together in such a way as to produce a cell is absolutely, I mean, it's incredible, nonsensical, really.
Okay, and from your point of view, that what the evolutionists would say is that has to be a chance thing.
Yes, you'd have to have very, very complex molecules, first of all, being formed, and then they'd have to all come together in some sort of in perfect way. The only way that could possibly happen is by some sort of intelligence.
Okay, thank you. Evan?
Well, that's just the standard argument of intelligent design. Things are complicated, so there must be an intelligent designer. It's simply not the case. If you think about all the parts of the universe where life could have evolved, we are where we are because life evolved here, and it's certainly true.
So it is down to chance, though, that first, if you like, the breeding of life.
Well, the fact that you're doing what you're doing is probably down to chance. If the other person at the interview for your job hadn't missed the bus, then you wouldn't be where you were, and if the bus hadn't been delayed. So everything is down to chance. The world that we're created is a consequence, to a certain extent, of chance happenings, and we just make do with it. But it's certainly true that you needed to have the ingredients, which certainly existed, for there to be the first replicable molecule, because obviously you have to have replication for selection to work on. Clearly that was a random event. It didn't happen before that because the chance event didn't happen, and it didn't happen since because it happened then. It didn't happen on Pluto. It didn't happen on Venus. It didn't happen in another solar system or another universe because, well, maybe it did. We don't know about it, but it happened here.
Okay.
And it's just an argument that...
And it's just that
powerlessness. We may as well not do anything because everything's God-given and we're not responsible, in a sense, for anything that happens. So we can just sit back and God will take care of it. I mean, we're getting into theology here, but the idea that chance is a bad thing is something that will be a, I think, forces you to be rather depressed about the state of your life and the world.
Evan must rely on chance to explain the origin of the first living organism, and I think he's got real problems, as we've just seen.
Why? Because Evan says, fine, it's chance, but big deal.
Okay, but chance is not adequate to explain the origin of life. In actual fact, we have a very narrow window of time. If you look at the geological record, you have a very narrow window of time to do it, even within the evolutionary worldview. The experiments that have been done since 1953, since Stanley Miller first did that famous experiment where he put gases in a flask and put electricity through them and he got some amino acids out at the bottom. 50 years of research, 50 years of funding, millions of pounds have been spent on this question, and we're absolutely nowhere close to finding a naturalistic solution to that. And the reason is that life is based on information. The genetic code, which forms the basis of every living organism, is like a software program, and we all know that software programs require programmers. And we don't know of any single example where information, and that's what the genetic code is, it's biological information. There is absolutely nothing in our present experience that makes us think that information comes from anywhere other than intelligent agency.
Nothing. You can tell that there's not a scientist making that point, because no scientist talks about there is no proof, that there's absolutely nothing, and these absolutes, that is the view of a fundamentalist. It's not science. The fact is that people used to say my argument is that people used to say that the eye was so complex that it could never have evolved because it's such a complex organ. Yet when people looked, they saw the fundamental building blocks of the human eye in lower forms of life, and so you could see an evolutionary process whereby those parts that worked well and then worked well together had a clear selection advantage. So the argument that because something's complex, it must have been designed rather than evolved is simply wrong. Not a provable absolute fact. And I'm sorry, Paul, that science doesn't work like a Bible where something's written down, you believe it all, and if you don't believe it all, you're not a full person. In your case, you're not a full Christian. There's a fundamental inconsistency. But science is different from religion, and I think religion should stick to its own world of absolute faith, and that we should try and work through good science. Clearly, there's bad science, but good science to try and identify the processes that work the physical world.
The problem of the origin of life is basically the problem of information. We're not just simply talking about complexity here. We're talking about information, coded information. In our universal experience, information comes about only through intelligent agency. If I went down to a beach and I found written in the sand the words, I love you, I could be absolutely clear that somebody, even if I hadn't seen them do it, even if I didn't know who they were, I could be absolutely clear that an intelligent agency was behind that, because I know that the laws of chance and natural law are simply not adequate to explain the origin of even a simple message. And yet at the heart of every living cell is complex biological information of the kind that if we found it coming to us in a radio signal from space, we would conclude that there was an intelligent agency, that there was extraterrestrial life.
But that's the Turin Shroud conundrum, isn't it? Because people see the face of Jesus in tea leaves, they see the Virgin Mary, the visage of the Virgin Mary and a stain on something, they see the face of Jesus in the Turin Shroud, and they believe that it must be, it cannot be chance, because it looks so realistic. And you see, the argument that it must be intelligent design, that we can't work out what's happened, is just an argument of despair. We may as well give up all scientific endeavor and just look at the Bible. And everyone that's involved in science should take a lazy approach to say, no, God told us the answer. It's this interpretation, usually my own interpretation of what the Bible says. And for people who don't have faith, in modern physics, then I urge them not to fly on planes, not to get on a train, and not to get in their car, because it must be a very, very scary experience for people who reject the scientific approach and rely on the Bible to use anything technological for which there's no description or validation in the Bible.
I don't reject the scientific approach. I trained in science. I love science. I'm an enthusiast for science. I encourage young people to go into science and be good Christian scientists. I love science. And if we look,
you'd be a good scientist if you're not a Christian.
Yes,
can you be?
Yes, you can. Yes, of course you can.
Well, then
as well.
You should just encourage people to be good scientists or to be Christians.
I
don't think the two should be connected, because you're introducing a bias, they might find.
And if we look at science historically, science was founded by men who had a broadly Christian worldview. Many of them were actually Christians themselves. Christians have always had a massive...
Had no choice to get the funding, did they?
Christians
they get burned if they didn't agree.
That's nonsense. Christians,
well, if you look at the persecution of Galileo and others...
Let's just allow Paul to
Christian
make his
church,
point, though, here.
You can understand why people were Christians who got anywhere in Christian Europe.
Galileo was not persecuted because he challenged the Bible. Galileo was persecuted because he challenged Aristotelian philosophy, which was the predominant science of the day. That's why he was persecuted.
The position is that there is a history of heretics, people who disagree with the word of God as interpreted by men, usually, I'll excuse you from this category, corrupt men, being persecuted, executed, and tortured, okay? That's what happened to heretics, okay? That's why I feel very strongly that we should ensure that science is kept separate from religion as far as possible. It's very important that we don't allow... If you proved me wrong, okay, I would agree with you. If I proved you wrong, you would never agree with me, because you don't believe that you can be proved wrong. I believe I could be proved wrong, okay? You don't believe you can be. That's the difference between us. And I'd rather live in a world where people making decisions felt themselves, their view to be fallible, than a world where people, however polite they were, however nice they were, however articulate they were, refused to accept that they could ever be wrong on something so fundamental.
There are so many points to pick up there. I mean, one of them is the fallacy that somehow Christians have opposed science down through the years and burnt all these scientists at the stake. Actually, that's a myth. It was largely put about by Andrew Dixon White in the 1880s as a polemic against Christianity, and it's actually historically not true at all.
The Inquisition?
Christianity grew up. Science grew up within a Christian worldview. It was largely founded by men of Christian convictions, and today we don't have any reason to be afraid of science. We are enthusiastic about science. We think that science is a gift from God, but we want to recognise the limitations of science and the things that it can and can't do.
That's anti-scientific to say that we're going to bound science and say there's certain areas that science will never be able to help us with, okay, that most people would like, certain areas of biology which people would think were absolutely biological, is a corruption of science. That's why I think it's fraudulent to say that you can have science that has to respect boundaries, because that, in other words, it threatens fundamentalist religious views. That corrupts science. It makes science too biased to be reliable. I'd like to live in a world where clearly science is bounded by morality, that we make decisions about the sort of science we want to do and the ethical way we do it, but we don't put pre-assumptions down on what science might discover, just in case it means that one religious sect is disadvantaged in terms of its ability to proselytize.
We're going to...
And that's the worry. That's what's going on.
Thank you, Evan. We're out of time. In fact, we're over time, and it's been really interesting. So we've only scratched the surface in many ways, and that's always the case on this programme, but I'm sure it's given plenty of people a lot of food for thought. Let's just have a final thought from both of you. Start with you, Paul. You know, ultimately, for you, what you're doing is scientific as far as you're concerned, because, as you've said on a number of occasions, you're coming at it with assumptions, just in the way that everyone who comes to science comes at it with assumptions.
I think one of the welcome outcomes of this whole controversy about creation and evolution is that it raises public awareness about the fact that Christians have always made positive contributions in the fields of science and education, and we're not about to stop. We're not about to just leave it to the secularists. Christians have always been positive about these things, and we're going to continue to be.
Okay. Evan, final thought from you.
I'm pleased to say I don't disagree with anything that's just been said about Christians who have contributed to science. I would make the point, however, that there are plenty of non-Christians who have very valid moral views, and indeed that religion does not have a monopoly on morality or philosophy, and that fundamentally we have to recognize that science is science and religion is religion, and that it's plain wrong to teach children that religion is science.
All right, thank you very much, both of our guests today. Paul Garner was joining us from Biblical Creation Ministries. If you want to see their website, it's biblicalcreation.org.uk. Evan Harris is a Liberal Democrat MP and their spokesperson on science, and I think your website is evanharris.org.uk. Is that correct, Evan?
That's right.
Okay. Thanks very much, gentlemen, both for being with us this afternoon. You've been listening to a debate on creationism and evolution here on Premier Christian Radio. Sorry if you called and weren't able to get through. I'm afraid we had more callers than we had time to take.